This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Kill Creek, written by Scott Thomas, performed by Bernard Sotero Clark. Gossip is mischievous, light, and easy to raise, but grievous to bear and hard to get rid of. No gossip ever dies away entirely if many people voice it. It, too, is a kind of divinity. Hesiod. Only the silent, sleepy, staring houses in the backwoods can tell all that has lain hidden since the early days. Sometimes one feels that it would be merciful to tear down these houses, for they must often dream. H.P. Lovecraft. Prologue. No house is born bad. Most are thought of fondly, even lovingly. In the beginning, the house on Kill Creek was no exception. The house was made from nothing more fantastic than wood and nails, mortar and stone. It was not built on unholy ground. It was not home to a witch or a warlock. In 1859, a solitary man constructed it with his own two hands and the occasional help from friends in the nearby settlement of Lawrence, Kansas. For a few good years, the many rooms within the grand house were filled with a passionate love, albeit one shared in secret, a whisper between two hearts. But as with most places rumored to be haunted, a tragedy befell the house on Kill Creek. The man who built it was murdered, mere feet from the woman he loved. His outstretched hands attempted to span that mockingly short distance between them, to touch her dark skin, to caress her hair, his mind insisting that if he could just hold her, they would both be saved, that if he could just wish hard enough, they could still be together. They were not saved. His love's body was taken from beside his own and hung from the only tree in the front yard, a gnarled beech. She was already dead, and yet they strung her up in one final insult. The bodies became as cool as the steamy August night would allow, the silence of the house and grounds lying over them like a death shroud. They would remain undisturbed for several weeks, forgotten as the town of Lawrence endured its own tragedy. As dusk fell, the horizon to the southwest flickered with the orange glow of flame. Lawrence was burning. A house stained by spilled blood cannot escape the harsh sentence passed by rumor. The townspeople, traveling the quiet dirt path to Kansas City, began to speak of the house as if it were alive. How badly they felt for the poor, sad place, orphaned as so many children had been during the bloody border battles preceding the Civil War. It is impossible to say what happened within that empty house on long, dark winter nights, when the wind cut through the barren forest to rattle its window panes. There was just something about the place that inspired travelers to quicken their pace as they passed Kill Creek Road. Because of its size and grand architecture, the house did not remain empty forever. A few tried to call it home. Yet no one felt completely welcome in the house, and most moved out within a year. They could not explain why they were compelled to abandon it. It was as if the walls refused to absorb their warmth. Even in the middle of summer, the temperature dropped a good 10 degrees as one passed over the threshold. It had become a bad place, a thing to be feared. In the late 1920s, Kansas Highway 10 was built, linking Kansas City and Lawrence. By the 1970s, the modest paved road had been expanded to a 4-lane highway. Speeding by at 55 miles per hour, the exit to Kill Creek Road was easy to miss, as was the sign that marked the creek itself. As life raced forward and simple times grew ever more hectic, the house on Kill Creek became just another empty farmhouse, left for the prairie to reclaim. Even the creek that had once fed so greedily from the Kansas River began to dry up, the sun baking its bed until it cracked like old flesh. The closest neighbors still shared stories about the strange things they'd witnessed over time. Lights passing in the windows, pounding on the doors, whispers in the darkness. But the house and its bloody history had been reduced to nothing more than a tall tale that parents told their children as they tucked them into bed. Most did not believe the stories. They were told simply to keep the children safe, to warn them of the dangers of exploring the dilapidated structure. The house must have been lonely then, the passion that had built it lost, pulled down into the earth like morning fog. In 1975, the Finch sisters, Rachel and Rebecca, bought the estate from the county, who had owned it since the last occupant abandoned it in the spring of 1961. The Finch sisters were not concerned about the house's dark history. They were 68-year-old identical twins, and they had seen and endured much worse than a few bumps in the night, especially Rebecca, who was confined to a wheelchair, the victim of a tragic accident of which neither woman spoke. When the Finches hired local hands to help them refurbish the once grand mansion, many welcomed their arrival, thinking the sisters would finally give the house the care and attention its original owner had intended. The Lawrence Journal World and the Kansas City Star both ran articles about the Finch sisters' arrival. "Kill Creek Mansion finally a home," announced one paper. "Twin sisters resurrect haunted house," proclaimed the other. The Finch sisters did not live up to those expectations. They were, as people in the region were wont to call them, odd birds. The Finches rarely spoke to the carpenters working on the house, and once moved in, they almost never stepped foot outside. If one of them could be regarded as friendly, it was Rachel, with her long, flowing black hair, who always paid the workers promptly and fairly. Rebecca, hair pulled painfully tight in a bun, was almost never seen, choosing to stay behind the closed door of the third floor's only bedroom. An elevator was one of the first additions allowing wheelchair-bound Rebecca to roam freely throughout the spacious house. Yet she was never about for long, always returning to that one room, a single 2-foot-wide window providing her only view of the outside world. Once, a plumber inspecting the pipes asked Rachel why her sister did not come downstairs more often. "It must get awfully lonely up there," he said. Without missing a beat, Rachel turned to the man, gave the closest approximation of a smile she could muster, and replied, "She has all the company she needs." 2 years later, Rebecca Finch was dead. According to the coroner, her heart had simply given out. Rachel continued to live in the house on Kill Creek, refusing visitors, even those who came to express their condolences for her sister's passing. No one except Rachel Finch walked the halls of that house for nearly 5 years. No living being, that is. So it came as a surprise when, in 1982, Rachel granted an interview to world-renowned parapsychologist and author, Dr. Malcolm Adderdell. Although most of the scientific community regarded him as a fraud, Dr. Adderdell's books, based on his adventures into the paranormal, were devoured by a public desperate to believe. Only Rachel Finch and Dr. Adderdell witnessed the occurrences during his weekend visit to that house. The resulting book, Phantoms of the Prairie, A True Story of Supernatural Terror, brought the house on Kill Creek to national attention. While critics and skeptics discounted the book as pure fiction, eager readers kept Phantoms of the Prairie on the bestseller list for an astounding 36 weeks. The story Dr. Adderdell wove was short on details and long on atmosphere, but for those seeking proof of the existence of ghosts, the book was all they needed. The house on Kill Creek was officially crowned a doorway to the other side. It was a house of nightmares. More importantly, it was once again known by name. Rachel Finch died in 1998. She was 91 years old. Just like the man who'd built her beloved mansion, Rachel's body was not discovered until several weeks after her death. Teenagers from suburban Kansas City had, on a dare, crossed the weathered bridge spanning the dry, dusty ravine that once was Kill Creek. They made it 100 feet from the front porch before coming to a sudden stop. There, swinging slowly in the beech tree, from the very branch that once supported the dead, slack weight of the original owner's forbidden love, was Rachel Finch. An amateurish knot dug into the stretched, rotting flesh below her chin. Her thin black hair fluttered softly in the breeze, and then settled upon her shoulders. As the onlookers tried to make sense of this sight, the rope creaked, and Rachel's body spun around to face them. A beetle crawled happily in one of the empty sockets that had housed her gray eyes. Many speculated as to what drove the old woman to hang herself. Some assumed it was sheer loneliness. The loss of her sister had become too much to bear. Others suggested that it was the house. The house had driven her to do it, although no one could say exactly why. And then there were the few, those who took morbid glee in tales of tragedy, who whispered in slow, deliberate voices that Rachel had not killed herself at all. She was dragged out of the house and hung from that branch against her will. Someone, or something, had done that to her. It was a reminder that the house was best left alone. After Rachel's death, all of the Finch sisters' belongings were left in the house, as stipulated in Rachel's will, including, one would presume, the furniture in the third-floor bedroom. No one knew for sure what that room held. Its entrance had been sealed shut, the staircase now ending in a wall of brick, as if no third floor had ever existed. Word spread once more that something was very, very wrong with the house on Kill Creek. Rachel Finch's death was just another chapter in its dark legacy. Eventually, the house and lot became the property of Douglas County. And, despite being on the market once more, no one dared move into the infamous structure. It still attracted its fair share of curiosity seekers, a constant source of busy work for the sheriff's department, who routinely patrolled the area. In 2008, a chain-link fence was erected around the grounds to keep out trespassers. The owners of the local business that donated the time and equipment for the job simply said they slept easier knowing that they had helped discourage others from approaching that house. They even threw in a coil of razor wire at the top of the fence for good measure. So the house fell silent once more, the yard overgrown with knee-high tall grass and clinging ivy. The house on Kill Creek still stands, empty, quiet, but not forgotten. Not entirely. Rumors are its life, stories its breath. Part 1. Invitation. Last October. I took another step into the abyss. "What's down here?" I called to her. I could sense her presence at the top of the stairs. "Don't worry," Rachel replied. "It's more scared of you than you are of it." I heard her chuckle, a laugh that stuck in her throat, never quite reaching her lips. As usual, I would have to see for myself. Dr. Malcolm Adudel, Phantoms of the Prairie. 1. Friday, October 7th. The air was on fire. Set into the stone wall was a towering Gothic window, the beveled panes of its enormous narrow body glowing in the afternoon sun. Dust motes swirled in the shaft of light blasting through the glass. Just beyond the light, in the shadows, things shifted restlessly. Faces, staring, silent, hungry. Their eyes were focused on a man in his late 30s, his brown hair buzzed to the scalp. He was handsome, just over 6 feet tall, dressed in old black Levi's and a Henley that showed off a thin, slightly muscular build. The shirt's long sleeves were pushed up to his elbows, revealing a collision of tattoos covering his left forearm. There was a strange, pitted texture to the skin into which the ink had been set, his entire left arm and the back of his hand wrapped in scar tissue. Dark lines snaked seemingly random courses across the flesh. But within the abstract arrangement, images emerged. Trees, a wild flower, the hollow eye of a skull, and flames, so many flames, devouring all. The man looked out at the 300 students stacked upon each other in the stadium seating of Budig Hall's Hoke Auditorium. No matter where he turned, he met someone's rapt gaze. Technically, they were here to attend a freshman-level class called Introduction to Horror in Popular Culture. But he knew why every seat in the lecture hall was currently filled. He was not only a Lawrence resident and a KU alumnus, but a best-selling author, an expert on the subject of horror. Sam felt the bristles of hair rub against his palm as he ran a hand over his shorn head. "Don't blow it. You're supposed to be a master of the macabre." He walked the length of the floor of the lecture hall, feeling every set of eyes tracking him like prey. "What don't we know?" he asked rhetorically, his voice echoing from the highest, darkest corners of the cavernous room. "What is hidden, purposely hidden from us? The Gothic tradition is about secrets, dark secrets, awful secrets, hidden just behind the facade of normality. Modern horror is still heavily influenced by this tradition, but it's not creepy old castles that hold these secrets anymore. The Gothic has invaded our everyday lives. The old farmhouse in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The suburban Japanese home in The Grudge. Even a videotape in The Ring. The infectious evil that used to be confined to crumbling ruins in 18th and 19th century literature, like Lewis's The Monk, Radcliffe's The Mysteries of Udolpho, and Maturin's Melmoth the Wanderer, has spread to our cities, our small towns, our homes. And that's what makes it even scarier, doesn't it? There was a murmur of agreement, a few heads nodding within the many-eyed mass before him. Sam began to pace more quickly, his own excitement on the subject growing. "So what makes some stories innately Gothic? A Nightmare on Elm Street hinges on the secret that the Elm Street parents are keeping from their children, that they took the law into their own hands and killed Freddy Krueger. Saw keeps us guessing about Jigsaw's true identity and motive. So why don't these feel as entrenched in the Gothic tradition as other horror movies?" The students glanced uneasily at each other, no one wanting to be the first to give a wrong answer. "Okay," Sam said finally. "I believe there are several key reasons." The chemical smell of a dry erase marker drifted into the air as Sam uncapped it. He turned to a massive whiteboard mounted on the back wall and quickly jotted down the first entry on his list. 1. Emanation from a single location, he said aloud as he wrote. He turned to lean over a heavy wooden lectern as he spoke directly to the class. "Yes, we're told in the very title that the nightmare is happening on Elm Street. But in the movie itself, we never get a sense that the evil truly emanates from this place. It does very little to give us a sense of the geography of Elm Street, the close proximity of the targeted kids, or even if Freddy's horrible acts, both past and present, are confined strictly to this part of Springwood. In the end, the antiseptic safety of Elm Street just juxtaposes nicely with the all-consuming threat of nightmare. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, on the other hand, is confined mostly to an old house in the Texas countryside. If those fatally curious kids never wandered over to Leatherface's house, they would have remained in one piece. The evil is behind that door. Don't open the door, and you got nothing to worry about." The dry erase marker squeaked its chipmunk voice as it sped once again over the board. 2. A sense of forbidden history. The location must have some dark history associated with it, whether it's the illicit affair of Quint and the former governess in The Turn of the Screw, or the suburban wet dream of the brand new housing development in Poltergeist. A neighborhood that just happens to have been built on top of the bodies of a relocated cemetery. Even in these examples, which are firmly rooted in the supernatural, the secret history is purposely kept from our protagonists. 3. An atmosphere of decay and ruin. This could be the physical decay of classic Gothic literature, the aforementioned crumbling castles and shadowy manors that continue to show up in films like The Others and The Woman in Black and Crimson Peak. But it could also be mental decay, like the main character in Roman Polanski's The Tenant, who moves into a seemingly innocuous apartment and proceeds to lose his mind. More often than not, it's a combination of the two. The ruin and decay of the physical structure leads to the ruin and decay of the mind of the protagonist. We see it again and again in books like The Haunting of Hill House and movies such as Session 9, in which the cleaning of an abandoned mental institution coincides with the mental degradation of the homicidal leader of the cleanup crew. And finally, Sam wrote the last item on the board. 4. Corruption of the innocent. That's you guys. This drew a laugh. He replaced the cap on the marker, set it on the ledge that ran along the bottom of the board, and returned to the lectern. This is perhaps the most important element of any good gothic horror story. Without it, what do you have? A shitty old dump with a dark history no one remembers or cares about. You need that one person who ensures that the evil lives on. From a shelf inside the lectern, Sam picked up a well-worn paperback. He held the book high so the entire class could see the elegant hand-drawn cover art and the classic font of the title and author's name. Last One Out Kills the Lights, by Sebastian Cole. You all should have a copy of this now. The majority of the students nodded, some displaying their own copies as evidence that they did as Sam had asked. You're probably wondering why I made you buy the entire book if we're just going to discuss one of the short stories inside. Well, it's because Sebastian Cole is one of the greatest horror authors ever, and I want to know that all of you own at least one of his books. Who here has read Sebastian Cole before? Several hands shot into the air, though sadly not as many as Sam had expected. From the center row, a pimply-faced kid called out, "A thinly cast shadow!" Sam nodded enthusiastically. Arguably Cole's best book, although picking a favorite from his vast body of work is, at least for me, incredibly difficult. Now, the story I asked you to read for today is, a hand shot into the air. It belonged to a young man of Middle Eastern descent. Even sitting down, he was clearly an exceptionally large person, his long legs bent awkwardly, knees pressing into the seat before him. His hand seemed to be reaching to touch the ceiling above. "Yes?" "What about your own books?" the young man asked. "How does all of this apply to them?" Another voice, a female voice from somewhere on the right side of the hall, followed this by calling out, "Tell us about Under the Rug!" Several overzealous students whistled and whooped. "Careful," Sam warned himself. "They want to peel you like an onion." He gave the rough reptilian flesh of his scarred arm a squeeze. The applause died away. "Okay, fair enough. How is the Gothic tradition represented in my work? Well, in Under the Rug, I tried to take advantage of these four elements to create a modern Gothic horror novel. A hard-working, blue-collar worker, a single dad, moves his young son to an old, dusty Oklahoma farm. There's number one on our list, emanation from a single location. He hopes that his blood and sweat will breathe new life into the rocky soil, that he can coax the earth into once again growing something. But he doesn't realize that this forgotten patch of land is barren because of what had happened there a century before. If you've read the novel, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, I won't spoil it for you, but it involves a child murderer and a stolen baby and an act of violent revenge. That's number two, forbidden history. Number three, decay and ruin, comes in the form of the farm itself. But it's also in what happens to the relationship between the father and his son. First, when the father's efforts to grow a crop result in nothing more than weeds, and later as the son begins to show signs of a strange, frightening psychic power. And there's number four. Corruption of the innocent. See, the power this boy begins to exhibit isn't a gift from God, but the side effect of a greater evil attempting to be reborn. Stir in some thematic parallels regarding fertility and the fragility of masculinity, give it a good shake with some hopefully unexpected deaths and startling violence, top it with a trapdoor, literally under the rug, and you've got yourself a smooth, tasty sip of modern Gothic horror, with just enough bite to remind you it ain't a kid's drink. There was a soft ripple of good-natured laughter. A pale, red-haired girl raised her hand. Before Sam could even address her, she asked, So what's your secret? Sam tasted smoke. His breath caught in his throat, nearly choking him. The air suddenly had a harsh, gray taste to it, like cinder and ash. I'm sorry, he said when he managed to swallow the breath. What do you mean? You said these types of books and movies, they're all about secrets, right? Her thin lips barely moved as she spoke, her voice so faint that Sam realized she was forcing him to lean toward her. The involuntary action filled him with a sudden, inexplicable anxiety. Yes, he began. She didn't let him continue. You've said that writing is personal, that an author always puts a piece of themselves in their stories. So, you know, what's your secret? Sam fell silent. From the last row of the stadium seats, a voice called down, She wants to know why you write horror. He peered up at that last row. The narrow shaft of sunlight had begun to arc across the seats of the lecture hall, but it had only reached the middle rows. The upper rows were in almost complete darkness. It was impossible to tell from which of the featureless shadows the statement had come. That thin wisp of smoke slithered down his throat and between his lungs, constricting, pushing breath through his teeth. The smoke serpent twisted beneath Sam's ribs and squeezed tighter, its gray head slipping around the ribbed stalk of his trachea. It pressed its upturned snout against the upper lobe of his lungs, probing for a way in. Why do you write horror? The deep voice boomed again. Sam McGarver was no longer in a grand lecture hall on the campus of University of Kansas. He was 10 years old, clothes spattered with blood that wasn't his own, the angry light of an unstoppable fire illuminating his face. He was just a boy, a tiny silhouette against the inferno. Sam, now a grown man, stood silently before his students until the bell rang, saving him from a question he did not want to answer. Eli Block sat in a crumpled suit on the porch of the Free State Brewery, a pint in one hand and his phone in the other. He'd barely touched the beer. He was only concerned with two things: writing a fuck you email to his assistant using as few characters as possible, and meeting with his number one client, Sam McGarver. Jesus, you look miserable, someone said. Eli looked up. Sam. Finally. Yeah, well, I am. I hate this place. I want you to move to New York immediately. Sam gave a weary smile. Not gonna happen. Eli made what room he could on the crowded bench. Sit. I'll be back. I need a beer. Drink mine. Eli passed his glass to Sam without waiting for a reply. Sam sat down on the bench's limited real estate. He tipped the glass and drank half the beer down in two large gulps. Tiny lighted pumpkins dangled overhead in zigzagging strings. One pumpkin was flickering on and off, threatening to give up the ghost at any moment. Sam leaned back against the wooden rail and took a deep breath, watching the pumpkin flicker. On and off. On and off. That bad? Eli asked. Sam swallowed another mouthful of beer. The glass was now almost completely empty. What do you want, Eli?
Just checking in. Want to know how you're doing.
And you fly in for that? You can't just call and ask? It was Eli's turn to fall silent as he searched for the right words. There were none. May as well rip the band-aid off.
Aaron called me. She's worried about you.
She shouldn't have done that.
I'm worried about you, too.
The last of the beer slipped through Sam's lips. He held the empty glass up to a nearby waitress, mouthing the words, pale ale. She nodded and disappeared inside.
You're not writing, Eli said bluntly. You don't know what you're talking about, Eli. Yeah? So you have something to show me? You have pages to share.
When it's done.
And when's that?
All of the pleasantry had gone from Eli's voice.
Bad Blood slipped off the paperback bestseller list over a year ago. People are asking when your next book is coming out, and I don't know what to tell them. I'm starting to doubt it ever will.
It's close, Sam said defensively.
Bullshit. I haven't seen page one of it. Neither has your editor.
You both will when it's done.
And when will that be?
Eli asked, a bit of desperation bleeding through.
You've been working on it for 2 years. Or you say you have.
There was no discernible movement in the crowd, but the waitress was somehow miraculously there again. She handed the fresh beer to Sam, who tilted his head toward Eli. Put it on his tab. She looked to Eli. He gave a sharp nod, and the waitress disappeared once again. Eli rubbed his sweaty hands on his pant legs, as if trying to smooth out the wrinkles.
What are you doing, man? You're not writing. You're hiding out in a damn classroom, teaching, talking about other people's books.
He paused, not quite sure if he should bring this up.
And you're about to go through a divorce.
We're separated, Sam corrected Eli.
Mm-hmm. Fine. And how many separated couples do you know who worked things out?
Sam said nothing.
Why are you trying to throw your career away?
I'm not.
Well, you're not fighting to keep it.
The crowd shifted suddenly as someone made their way toward the front door. The entire mass rippled like a segmented insect inching its way up a leaf. The movement caused a bearded guy in front of Sam to take a step back, bumping Sam's shoulder. The beer in Sam's hand sloshed over the rim of the glass, a cold line coursing down his wrist and into the haphazard grooves of his scars. Everything I write feels thin. Fake, Sam admitted abruptly. He frowned as if surprised by his own words. Everything I write, I hear Aaron saying there's a better story in me.
Is there?
Eli asked. It was not an insinuation of doubt. It was an honest question. I'm sorry you flew all the way here, Sam said. He downed half of the new beer. I love you, Eli, but you could have just called.
I know, Eli said.
Sam stood, patted Eli on the shoulder, and started to push his way through the crowd. He was almost off the porch and onto the sidewalk when Eli called after him.
Why do you write horror?
Sam stopped cold. There it was, the voice that had called down from the shadows high in the corner of Budig Hall. Slowly Sam turned back to face him. That was you? Eli did not look away. He was ready for a fight, if that's what it took.
I had to see what was keeping my most talented writer from actually writing. Whatever's stopping you from finishing your book, you need to face it and move on. You can't hide out in a classroom forever.
Fuck you, Eli.
If you think Aaron is right, Sam, if you think there is a better story in you, then tell it. Write something you actually give a shit about. If there is something you give a shit about these days.
Sam didn't bother with a response. He slipped through an opening in the crowd and was gone. The bottle of Bullet was still on the counter. There was the clink of glass as Sam took a tumbler from a cabinet and poured himself 2 fingers of whiskey. He sipped, the burn loosening the constrictor in his chest. The suffocating cloud of ash and smoke was replaced by the soothing heat of alcohol. He closed his eyes and felt the warmth spread from his chest to his extremities. Sam drifted into the living room and stood in the perfect stillness of the empty house. There was a separate dining room beyond this, and above, 2 bathrooms and 3 bedrooms, one of which he used as his home office. All were exactly as they'd been when he and Aaron first moved in 5 years ago. Only they were his rooms now. His house. Sam raised the glass to his lips but did not drink. He stood there, an insect frozen in amber as time marched on without him. He wished he could exist only in this spot. He did not want to go to bed alone, and he did not want to sit in front of a blank page on his computer and be judged. He wanted to be here, right here, never moving, safe from the dangers of his own momentum. From the room at the end of the second floor hallway came a faint ding. His office computer announcing the arrival of an email. A second later, his phone buzzed in his pocket. Sam fished out his phone and the screen illuminated. There she was, Erin, more beautiful in her mid-30s than she'd ever been, green eyes bright and filled with joy, arms wrapped around Sam's waist, her cheek pressed against his. Time to change the old wallpaper, Sammy. He pressed the home button, grateful as the photo was covered by a sea of apps. A1 in a red circle hovered over the corner of his mail app. Sam tapped it. His inbox appeared. The new email stood out in bold black letters. His brow furrowed as he read the subject line. An invitation. And above this, the address of the sender. Wainwright@rightwire.com. He opened the email and scanned the body of the message. Around him, the empty house waited patiently for Sam to break the silence. 2. Saturday, October 8th. The blade sliced downward, easily exposing the wet red flesh beneath. The man's thick tongue licked his lips anxiously as he slipped the bit of meat between his crooked teeth. Clear juices ran down to the edge of his chin.
"You know how excited we are to work with you," he said around the mouthful. "We mean it. We're still very, very excited to work with you."
T.C. Moore watched the doughy, balding man in the baggy black suit devour his steak and thought to herself, "So this is what it is. Not a chance to repair the fissure. This meeting is a complete finger-fuck. And not even a good one." She had gone to the dinner hoping it would defy her expectations. They had greeted her with smiles and hugs, with kisses on the cheek. One of them had actually pulled out her chair for her, as if the four-legged piece of furniture were too complicated a contraption for her to operate. They had ordered stiff cocktails, each trying to impress with their intimate knowledge of whiskey and scotch. They had nibbled on small plates of house-cured meats and local cheeses, on grilled octopus and hamachi, beef tartare and lamb belly. They were all easy smiles, even as she sat in the dim light of the West Hollywood steakhouse with her sunglasses on, arms folded across her chest. They assured her that they were here to discuss the project on equal terms. They wanted to move forward with a clean slate. But they were all full of shit. She could tell by the hollow compliments, the tentative praise. There was another shoe to drop. God damn it. She should have known this was going to happen. The man in the baggy black suit wiped his mouth on the linen napkin and began to eagerly cut off another slice of filet mignon. "So," he said, tongue lapping at the juice on his chin, "we just wanted to hear how you see this project. You know, what you think it's really about." He shoved an even larger hunk of steak into his mouth and chewed noisily. Moore looked from this man to the men sitting on either side of him. The man in the center was Gary Bryson, the head of the studio. To his left was his vice president of development, Tanner Sterling, a rail-thin weasel in baby blue glasses and a checkered button-down shirt. Tanner always had half a smirk on his stupid face, as if everyone he met was a flat-out idiot, and therefore deserving of endless contempt. To Gary's right was Philip Chance, the producer on the project, and a genuinely okay guy. But a nice disposition rarely came paired with a backbone. Philip shifted uncomfortably in his seat, his under-seasoned and overpriced meal barely touched. He was in his mid-60s, thin skin hanging loosely from his skull. Above deep canyons of shadow were kind brown eyes. He clearly did not enjoy being caught in the middle. "What I think it's about?" Moore asked. Each word was a sliver of ice.
"If you don't mind,"
Gary said, lips smacking loudly. Tanner leaned in closer while Philip shrank back in his seat. Moore ran a hand over the jet-black length of hair draped over her shoulder as if it were a beloved pet. The sides of her head were shaved to the scalp. The darkly tinted lenses of her sunglasses caught the reflection of a nearby candle, the flame dancing as if her eyes were on fire. What do I think the screenplay based on my own novel is about? Are you fucking serious? Gary's mouth hung open as he froze mid-chew.
We just... He swallowed hard and cleared his throat. We want to know what your vision is.
My vision? You mean my book?
Moore leaned back in her chair and looked around at the people seated at the tables around them. A shallow collection of wealthy industry types in skinny suits, bearded hipsters with poofy greased-back coifs, and skeletal blondes with lips as thick as blood-filled leeches. Unidentifiable electronic music thumped from round white speakers mounted in the ceiling. For an uncomfortably long time, Moore said nothing. Tanner rubbed his sweaty palms together. When he spoke, Moore thought of an annoying little cartoon mouse in thick round glasses, the kind of character you hope gets ripped to shreds by a hungry cat.
We're just trying to get on the same page here.
Moore snapped her head around so quickly her mane of black hair rose up from her shoulder like a striking snake. Have you read my book?
Of course I've read it.
Describe it to me. Tanner shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
I don't think I have to
describe it to me, Moore repeated. Tanner was in the hot seat. He gave a sharp, incredulous snort.
Are you serious?
You seem to be the expert. Tanner looked to Gary. He did not want to speak out of school. This was not lost on Moore. Fuck you, Tanner. She tilted her head to stare at the boss man in the baggy black suit. His steak was momentarily forgotten, its juices beginning to congeal on the plate. What is this really about, Gary? Moore asked. Why did you ask me to dinner? Gary set his fork down.
Look, sweetheart, it has nothing to do with your novel.
Sweetheart, call me that again.
We love it. That's why we bought the rights to it.
Love it, Tanner repeated.
It's just a little... extreme.
Just a little, Tanner parroted again.
We want to tone it down a bit. Try to reach a wider audience.
You mean you want to turn it into a PG-13 teen romance? Moore seethed.
No, Gary insisted. No, we're simply focusing more on the dark love story at the heart of it. Make the subject matter a bit more palatable.
Reaching down into the sleek leather purse hanging from the back of her chair, Moore pulled out a paperback book and tossed it onto the table. It landed dead center, the weight of its 432 pages causing silverware to clank against plates and ice to bob in cocktail glasses. Tell me what you see. It was not so much a demand as a dare. All three men looked to the book's cover. The image was simple and explicit, like the cover images of all of Moore's novels. A teenage girl's hand held a bloody razor blade over her bare thigh. Carved into the thigh in crude, jagged letters was the title of the book, Cutter. The shadow of a second hand, this one clearly male in its size and menace, fell over the girl's wrist, as if it had guided her in the self-mutilation of her supple flesh. The spine of the book was creased with countless lines. The upper right corner bulged with dog-eared pages. Gary was the only one to take the dare.
Well, it's a very complex book. It's sexy, it's dark. That's why we want to tell this story. Why we want to capture the essence of your novel.
Okay, Moore cut him off. So obviously no one's bothered to take your dick out of their mouth long enough to give you the back cover synopsis, so allow me. She picked the paperback up off the table and turned it over to read the paragraph printed on the back. Set in a seemingly idyllic suburban town grappling with a rash of teen suicides, Cutter is the pitch-black tale of a clique of high school burnouts growing bored of homemade drugs and casual sex. Desperate for a new thrill to shake up their painfully dull lives, they decide to break into and vandalize a classmate's home.
They find the girl dead by her own hand, her body covered in thousands of slices from a bare razor blade.
Tanner gave an irritated sigh. "Please, Miss Moore, we know what the book is about."
"This is where it gets good," she said, ignoring him. "Open on the floor is an ancient, unholy tome, a self-hurt guide to astral projection through self-mutilation. Soon the teenagers are engaging in increasingly violent rituals as they leave their bleeding bodies to surf the outer edges of reality on orgasmic joyrides."
"Is this really necessary?" Tanner asked.
"Yes. Yes, it is," she said clearly and plainly. And then she continued reading. "But something wants to keep them from returning. Something far more perverse, far more powerful than anything they've dreamed in their wildest fantasies or darkest nightmares."
"What is your point, Miss Moore?"
Without warning, Moore ripped off her sunglasses. Her eyes were gray and cold, flecks of green in her irises offering the hint of life, like moss creeping over ancient stone. But there was something distinctly different about her right eye. The pupil. It was ruptured like the smeared black yolk of a bad egg. Its oblong body bled into the iris, threatening to devour what little color existed there. "What about that sounds like a goddamn love story?"
"No one wants to turn Cutter into a love story," Gary assured her.
Slowly, Moore turned to face him. Her ruptured pupil seemed to expand, sucking in what little light hovered around their table. "I know you've brought a new writer on board. I've read the latest draft of the script." Gary's eyes flashed to Tanner, who immediately shrugged and passed the buck by turning his own accusatory glare on Philip.
"She had every right to see it," Philip said.
Gary rubbed a hand over his slick, pasty forehead.
"Oh, Christ, Philip. What the hell is wrong with you?"
"All we're doing is trying to appeal to a larger audience," Tanner insisted. He was trying to regain control. "So we've taken the most sympathetic characters in the book and elevated them."
"Elevated them," Moore sneered.
"That's right.
What you did was invent a love story that doesn't exist in my novel in order to turn the whole movie into some sort of pathetic, mystical Twilight bullshit."
"And honestly, what the fuck is wrong with that?"
Gary spat.
"It's not my book."
"You're right. It's not your book." Gary leaned back in his chair.
"It's our movie."
There it is. The truth. Finally. The time for pleasantries had long passed. Gary had Moore right where he wanted her, and everyone at the table knew it.
"We own the rights. You had your pass at the screenplay. Our deal with you is done. And now we're going to make Cutter the way we see it. Hell, we'll probably end up changing the fucking title, too, you know, to something less grotesque. You want to scream and stomp your stilettos at somebody? Try the lawyer who made your deal in the first place. Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to finish my steak. I might even order dessert. You can stay or you can go. It's up to you."
Picking up his knife and fork, Gary hacked off a chunk of cold steak and popped it happily into his smirking mouth. He stared straight at her as he relished both the meat and the moment. Slowly, Moore replaced her sunglasses. And then, to everyone's surprise, she began to nod. "You're right," she said. For the second time that night, Gary stopped mid-chew. Moore ran her hands over the shaved sides of her head as if throwing back a hood that had temporarily blinded her. "You're right. I guess I wasn't thinking about it that way." Gary's eyes darted to Tanner and narrowed as if to say, "What the hell is this bitch up to?" Tanner shrugged. Reaching across the table, Moore touched Gary's hand. The edges of her silver fingernails lightly grazed his sun-damaged flesh. A shiver ran from the base of his skull down to the tip of his cock. "I'm sorry, Gary," she said. "I really didn't come here to fight." Gary turned his attention from his meal, letting his gaze pause briefly on the exposed curve of Moore's breasts, before settling on the dark lenses of her glasses. The flickering flames were back. Captured there. Dancing. It's just... horror is very important to me. She took his stubby fingers in hers and drew his hand closer.
Well, I mean, I get that, Gary babbled. I don't blame you for speaking your mind.
Moore laughed, relieved. Thank goodness. I'm sorry, I hope I didn't offend you. With his free hand, Gary waved the apology away like a foul odor.
Not at all. It's fine, really.
Tanner and Philip were watching the exchange with growing disbelief. Neither man had ever heard T.C. Moore apologize for anything.
I just need you to truly understand something.
She was staring at Gary's hand with something close to adoration. With one of her silver nails, she traced an ambiguous pattern up over his hairy knuckles and across the back of his hand to his wrist. Gary straightened up in his seat. Moore let her caress drift back down to the tip of the man's index finger. His nails displayed the perfection of a top-dollar manicure, the only part of him that appeared meticulously kept.
You see, to me, horror is something that must be experienced.
I understand.
It's not light and fluffy.
Yes.
She gave his index finger a light tug, like a farmer testing a teat. An almost imperceptible gasp escaped Gary's plump lips. Tanner looked to Philip in disbelief. They were both realizing they no longer existed at the table. They were unnecessary. This moment belonged to Moore and Gary and no one else.
Horror is a lot like sex, Moore continued. It's raw, and it's primal, and when it's good, when it's really good, it even hurts a little. But the good kind of pain, you know?
The doughy man nodded and made a sound that he meant to be a word, but in reality was nothing more than a breath. Moore stroked his finger, up and down, up and down.
Because that's what horror is. Pain. Unbearable, all-consuming pain. So real and brutal that we almost crave it in a sick way. It prickles our flesh and gets our pussies wet and our cocks hard. We need it to feel real. It reassures us that we exist. And what's truly frightening is when we realize that our pursuit of that sensation, of that reassurance of our own validity, has led us to a dark, terrible place from which there is no escape. That's true horror. When the seducer turns on us, and we are no longer in charge, we've lost control, and now we have to pay an awful, unspeakable price.
Moore gripped Gary's finger so tightly the tip went white. With her other hand, she snatched the steak knife from his plate.
Like how a second ago you actually thought I was coming on to you.
Moore pressed the point of the knife against his finger, resting it just under the beautifully manicured nail.
And now I'm about to jam a fucking steak knife under your goddamn fingernail.
Moore pushed the knife forward ever so slightly, its tip sinking into the soft flesh. A tiny spot of blood blossomed under his nail. A horrible sound, like the terrified yelp of a kicked puppy, escaped Gary's open mouth. He jerked his hand back and Moore let him, releasing her grip on his finger. Tanner lunged across the table, but Moore had already set the knife down and was on her feet.
You bitch! Gary hissed. You crazy fucking bitch!
The entire restaurant came to a standstill, all eyes on Moore and the three men at her table.
Thanks for dinner, Gare. It's been a real pleasure.
She slung the steel chain-link strap of her purse over her shoulder, her black hair curling around the links like the tendrils of a sentient plant. She pointed a silver nail at the paperback on the table.
Keep the book, she said.
You might even want to try reading it.
You're done! You hear me?
Gary's body heaved with anger. But Moore was already pushing through the front door and into the still, warm air of a California autumn night. Headlights streaked across the face of the hilltop home, illuminating the mid-century modern's unforgiving facade of concrete and glass. The chrome Maserati Gran Turismo whipped into the driveway. Tires chirped as it came to an abrupt stop. The engine had barely died when Moore burst out of the driver's side. She was shaking, her entire body racked with uncontrollable spasms. She had been fine when she left the restaurant, her hands steady on the steering wheel, but the higher she drove into the Hollywood Hills, the closer she got to home, the more she began to tremble. Had her house been one block farther up the twisting narrow road, she feared her quivering hands would have sent her sailing over the edge and into the canyon below. But she was home now. She was safe.
Then why am I still shaking like a fucking chihuahua?
The sensation filled her with rage, and an explosion of adrenaline shot through her veins. She felt her heart pound furiously in her chest.
Take a breath,
she commanded herself. And she did, drawing the cooling night air deep into her lungs. She began to steady. Her hands stopped shaking, and the rest of her limbs followed suit. For a solid minute, Moore stood at the edge of her driveway and just breathed. In and out. In and out. Okay, she thought. Okay. She was in control again. The panic, for the moment, was defeated.
Bitch, you need to get a grip,
she said to herself, chuckling at the sound of her own voice. She was halfway up the front walk when she saw the small, pale rectangle hovering, apparently in mid-air, before her front door. As she got closer, she realized it wasn't actually floating. It was taped to the heavy oak door, the glow of a nearby streetlight bouncing off the surface of the cream-colored envelope to create the optical illusion. Written across the front of the envelope, in an elegant script, were two words. An invitation. Moore was reaching to rip the envelope from the door when she paused, suddenly frozen in place. There was no stamp, no return address. It had been hand-delivered.
Don't open it, her mind warned her.
It was an irrational thought. There was no reason to fear the contents of the envelope. Yet her mind turned over every stone, every possibility. A love letter from a stalker. Hate mail from an angry parent who blamed her for their child's self-harm. Pleasantries from a neighbor she did not care to know. And then there was the most troubling prospect of all, that it was none of these things. That it was something entirely unexpected. The words came again, louder this time. Don't open it. T.C. Moore stood at her front door, the October breeze running invisible fingers through her wild mane of black hair. 3. Tuesday, October 11th. It was the house. Something was reaching inside, surrounding him, suffocating him. Silence. A silence that made it hard to breathe. Outside the large picture window in the second floor office, the dark, jagged shapes of bare treetops swayed against a night sky illuminated by an unseen streetlight. Branches jutted out of the blackness like piles of misshapen bones, clinging desperately to brittle autumn leaves. The wind whipped up, angry and invisible, and swirled past the double-pane window. It whistled softly as it went, a strange minor tune. And then it was gone. The house was silent once more. Sam sat at the heavy wooden desk with its flaking white paint and ghosts of coffee cup stains. He stared at his monitor, the cursor on the blank page taunting him. Blink, 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 the cursor went, a beat to which his fingers once danced. No longer. Now they were folded reluctantly in his lap. He willed them to life, to leap to the keys and put on their best Fred Astaire. They did not. He had started this new novel at least 100 times. He had exhausted more first sentences than he could remember. They were single lines on one-page documents saved on his hard drive in a folder named, appropriately, Crap. Little Keller Reed woke up in the middle of the night, his breath like a frozen cloud in the dark, and he knew the man had come out of his closet again. It took 4 of them to lift the sun-bleached headstone in the